spending on tens of thousands in travel and P-cards and all these other things. This has all triggered a two-year OEIG investigation. This has been going on for a while. Now, if any of this isn't familiar to you, I know that most of you have already heard much of this. But what I brought to you to rant and rave is this whole thing about mission critical. All this spending was not mission critical initially. I mean, mission critical spending, that means somebody at purchasing gets to decide whether or not a faculty's decision on spending is mission critical. It is the faculty's right to control the academic environment. And that includes buying equipment, repairing equipment, buying supplies. I mean, this has been going on for a while. This is not new. It just got worse in January. These are nice people. They're not that they're not terrible, but they're unqualified to tell me whether or not that stuff's mission critical. I mean, do they have a PhD in electrical engineering or material science or mechanical engineering? They really have no handle on what's mission critical. I mean, Dr. Phillips has a degree in engineering, but he's a different engineer than I am. He has no idea what I consider mission critical. In fact, he probably doesn't know half the time what I'm talking about because it's a different world. So, putting a justification for legal reasons is good public policy. I have no problem with justifying. Justifications don't have to be long, arduous justifications that block the attempt at getting stuff done. A paragraph, two paragraphs, and most of the stuff, equipment's broken, it's used in the lab, I need $4,000 to fix it, some stuff like that. It's not big stuff. We're not spendthrift faculty. We're not out there trying to break the back of the university. We're just trying to get our jobs done. You know, and some people are saying, well, we have to make payroll. Well, there was a recent analysis by the American Association of University Professors on our finances, on NIU's finances. They spent looked back five years at our finances. Howard Bunn says he's well known, he does this for a living. And that 5 year said that we have, you know, we're, you know, state's terrible, but we're not in terrible shape. We're in pretty good shape overall, was his analysis. We have about $140 million in reserves. That may be, and some of it is in bonded reserves and stuff, but I'm saying that we have about 140, according to state documents that you filed last year. So if that's not true, then the auditors have to know that there isn't a reserve. So putting justification, like I said, so we need to have the ability to use our 41 accounts. 41 accounts are our local accounts that we've used for business reasons. We brought money in from outside contracts, from research, other things. We need access to our student fee money to fix equipment. I mean, the student fee money is just as restricted as any other money, and probably even more restricted. So, I mean, these things support students. So thank you very much and appreciate the time.
Thank you. I know that your comments were made with the best of intentions and in the best interest of the university. I would like to, this is very timely for us to recognize Dr. Gregory Long, who's president of the Faculty Senate and executive secretary of University Council. The initial comments were rather inflammatory in regards to no shared governance, and since you're the closest person to this issue representing the Faculty Senate, perhaps you might even want to make a comment in that regard.
Thank you, Trustee Muir. From our standpoint, or from my standpoint particularly, I support whatever decision the faculty makes with regard to unionization. I do, however, in the process of, as we move through the collective bargaining process and so forth, want to ensure the integrity of shared governance, because depending upon how things are worked out, shared governance may have more or less of a role. I certainly want to see that we maintain our role relative to curricular aspects, and so we'll be working to ensure that, have made contact with some other universities who have gone through this unionization process to start developing my background knowledge as far as how we move forward to make sure, again, that shared governance includes faculty, staff, and students in a way that is still meaningful.
Thank you. Mr. Steve Bulta, who is president of SPS Council and the faculty representative to the Carl Committee?
He's not here today.
He's not here. Okay. Good.
Holly Nicholson is.
Holly, would you like to make a comment?
Yes, please. The Operating Staff Council met this week to discuss the Program Prioritization Administrative Report. And I want to start by saying the report was excellent, well thought out, and it represented well the months of hard work that the task force did and demonstrated their ability to put the mission of the university first and take a look at, objectively at the programs. And I think that what they had to work with was the what was delivered to them, you know, the quality of the writing and people who are experts in their field to inform them of what they've been doing and why their area is mission critical. And I believe the resulting report was a very good quality. Regarding operating staff, there's one theme in the report that was cause for concern, and that was outsourcing. We want to reiterate the importance of keeping departments such as building services and grounds within the university and address issues identified in the report with strategic hiring and management training. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any other remarks that would like that anyone would like to share? Dr. Long?
As I was responding to the initial question, but I did want to note in our agenda this morning for this meeting the upcoming discussion on the risk management initiative, and reiterate my point of that I've made before that I think it's also important that we look at the physical and technology accessibility of what we do on campus. And I know that the Presidential Commission on Persons with Disabilities is working on this, coming up with some recommended policies. Talking with David Stone, and we'll continue to develop this further. But just would like to continue support for accessibility, both physical and technological, as an emphasis within our risk management. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, I would like to also make a point that when we make these introductions at the beginning of each of our committee meetings, those introductions are not perfunctory. They are very substantive, and your comments are always well thought. It is a reflection of the commitment that this university has to shared governance and a commitment that this university has to listen. So thank you very much for your, both of you, for your comments. Okay. The agenda today continues our effort to keep the committee updated on issues within its jurisdiction while simultaneously providing an opportunity to have substantive discussion of issues which may require committee action. There are four items which fall within the informational category of agenda. The first item fulfills a request of the committee to provide regular updates on the Enterprise Risk Management Initiative. Dr. Phillips will also give a summary of the fiscal year 2015 external audit. I think both of these issues are very critical, and I think the fact that we continue to have very timely updates in terms of progress and recommendations related in particular to the risk management initiative is key. The next item will be presented by James Gagliardo. It is a report on Governor Rauner's new Executive Order 1604 and a discussion of the BOT compliance with our obligation to disclose our economic interest statements. We will also hear from our Director of Internal Audit, Danielle Schultz, who will present on the Internal Audit Department Quality Assurance Review. And the last item, the audit charter approval, is required by statute and requires committee action. So in that regard, we'd like to begin with Dr. Phillips. Delighted that Dr. Phillips and Dr. Stone came to my office about 2 weeks ago so that we could have an informal meeting in regards to the progress being made on this initiative. So thank you for the time that you took to come in and orient me. All right, Dr. Phillips.
Good morning, Chair Muir, Board of Trustees. As you know, we've put a lot of work into to enterprise risk management for the entire university. This was an effort that started a number of months ago, and I'm pleased to say that we continue to make good, steady, solid progress addressing those risks, previously known or unknown. And so what we're going to talk about this morning is how far we've come in that effort and what some of the outcomes look like. And I will have Dr. Stone talk more specifically about the work that he is leading, pulling this all together. So as you know, the goals and objectives, you've seen this before, and create a culture of risk awareness, reduces surprise and losses, increase capacity to identify and seize opportunities, enhance decision-making, and improve efficiency and effectiveness of institutional risk management efforts. And along with this is also to develop the process whereby we incorporate these risks into the budget process. So when we identify a risk or a need for mitigation, we have a mechanism that it actually is addressed in the budget process, because we all know that those things that are funded are the things that get done. Very briefly, our core team, led by Dr. Stone. And this is the full team, which also met a couple of weeks ago as part of the process. The first time we had pulled them together was a three-hour session. As you can see, this is being taken very seriously by the senior leadership at the university. And at the meeting, basically, there were a number of vice presidents and associate vice presidents from all the departments participating in the effort. So where are we? We are now into phase four. We've identified the objectives, identified controls. We've assessed risks. We are now identifying key risk factors, interactions among those factors, and priorities. And our progress to date has been completed for 16 units across campus. The last time we met, we had done all but, I think, two or three. Those have been completed. We've had over 100 senior leaders from all the divisions at the university engaged in this effort. We have identified 188 risks, which is more than we thought we would have when we started out in terms of major areas of concern. We've done the risk assessment. Now we are doing the risk mitigation, and we've looked at cascading risks. As this is rather hard to read, each of you has a copy of the full list of all 188 risks. They are color-coded by division, and I will ask that Dr. Stone come up and talk about this chart, our dashboards that we're putting together, and the process whereby we have gotten to this point.
Thank you, Dr. Phillips. Good morning, trustees. So the list you have in front of you is not complete because, as you'll see, the last two columns are not finished. But to date, as we have explored the identification of risks, asked each of the units that we've met with, mostly in three-hour meetings, long discussions of these risks and the nature of them. So we've got assessment scores in terms of likelihood and severity. We've looked at risk velocity, which is risks where from the moment the incident would happen, if we don't have the ability to mitigate it before its full effects are felt, that was given a score. When we met with the full team a couple of weeks ago, the red, yellows, and greens indicate places where we identified important cascading risks. So a risk event happens in one area and there's immediate spillover to many others. So if there was high spillover, high cascading risk to other areas, that got a red. So as you'll see, if something had the same score so far, which, for example, the 30s, some of those are coded red, some are yellow, and some are green. That's the level of cascading risk there. So the last two columns have to do with mitigation. So we're now going around and re-meeting with all the folks who are in this sort of top 40 of risks. And we're talking to them about where are you now in preventing these risks, in limiting their likelihood, in limiting the severity in case they happen, and where things have been put in place or where those weren't discussed when we initially did the assessment scores, we're readjusting those. So this final list won't be complete until we've completed our mitigation reviews. Once we've done that, the full team will meet again, and we'll eyeball the entire list and talk about things that maybe are missing, things that weren't identified by this process that need to be put on the list somehow. We'll probably talk about the relative weights of some of these from the perspective of the full team. And then from there, what will be created for probably the top 15 or 20, and this will be a decision made by the full team, the senior leadership and the board will be given forms that look roughly like this. We haven't had this blessed by the full team yet, but it's essentially a dashboard form that identifies the risk, that explains its assessment level, its current severity, its current likelihood, and ongoing mitigation activities for that risk. These will probably be given to you quarterly, probably in advance of the CARL meetings in each case, and the hope is that over time, the reds will move to yellows, the yellows will move to greens, and we'll be reducing many of these risks. For those for which we've identified significant risk and limited mitigation at this point, and this is where Dr. Phillips was talking about combining the ERM effort with long-term budgeting and planning, the goal will be to have groups that need to identify new mitigation strategies that require new resources to fill out a form that will look something like this, that will detail the mitigation steps that need to be taken, that will provide a budget for those steps, that will provide a timeline that goes along with that budget, so that Dr. Phillips can rank order the needs in terms of identified risks and efforts to mitigate. And then, come on, next step. All right. So we'll complete the mitigation reviews in the next week or so. We'll have the full ERM team meeting in early June in advance of your final board meeting. We'll review the final risk rankings there. We'll approve those dashboard elements and the forms. And we'll begin a conversation about what kind of organizational structure we'll need to carry this effort forward, because obviously this is iterative. This was a first start. We've gotten 188 risks on the table. We've managed to rank them in some reasonable order. It's not perfect. It's not complete information. But in the process, we've educated over 100 people in the vocabulary, in the logic. They will go away with those documents. They will know where their risks are. They will know what's mitigated on their end and what's not, what they need to work toward. They will be given the same forms so that they can track the progress that they're making in mitigating their own risks that they can use in their internal meetings. And the hope is through that process over the next coming years, we'll develop a culture of risk-informed decision-making. So I'm happy to take questions.
Excellent. Any questions? I do have a question perhaps for Dr. Phillips. I've sat back and watched this process for, I don't know, how long? 9 months?
A few
8 months?
Months?
6 months? Whatever. And I certainly want to commend both of you. And I think we've made a lot of progress in this, really at the type of presentation and how we are addressing these issues. But I was interested to learn from you, what are your impressions about the process itself, and what learning experiences have you seen, not only from both of you, but really all of the participants, and has the process itself provided a value?
Absolutely. The first takeaway from this is that all the people that were brought together to do this were passionate about this, were extremely engaged, and took this very seriously. The second thing was that once you get people in a room, they learn about other risks from other people that might actually impact them in many ways or are certainly things that they should be thinking about. The other thing was that everybody views this as extremely important to not only the success of their own divisions or organizations, but to the university. And they have all been extremely helpful in helping us move this forward. The other thing that I think is good about this is an ongoing effort. So we are turning this into an enterprise risk management program, where now we will continue to evaluate, we will continue to assess, we will continue to have these meetings and address our shortfalls and actually put together plans for how we're going to fix them or address them or mitigate the risk. So it's been very positive. It's been very encouraging. And probably the best thing about this was the serious involvement of all the people who were involved in this, and they continue to be.
Will there be opportunity for any interface with internal audit in regards to these the objectives that you've identified as risk?
Absolutely. And in fact, for some of these risks, they may actually create opportunities for audits to be conducted to look into things in a more specific way in a number of the areas, such as financial kinds of issues and the things beyond just insurance and managing risk in those ways. So if we identify, because it's not all about the funding, in some cases it's about processes, procedures, it's putting documentation in place, systems, and in that way the internal auditor can certainly be of help.
You know, I think that the challenges in the future for organizations, whether it's higher education or any other sector, is to mitigate silos, especially in large organizations. In good times, we really have that tendency to be very silo-oriented. In complex times, and that's not just financially complex, but as we look to what the future may hold for all of us, the more we can integrate and have horizontal integration and not just the depth of a silo, I think we'll learn from each other. So I hope this can be used as an example. You know, this can be a catalyst to do this. And especially, and I look to Danielle in the audience, I think the identification of internal audit issues and what we are actually auditing internally has always been a question. How do we pick out of a myriad of things? And I think that this gives us a good roadmap to then have that vertical analysis of it's not just identifying a risk, it's not just by conjecture, but we've really taken a real in-depth look at it. I will ask you one more thing as the leadership of this project. When you bring us the final report, work very hard against the tendency of volume to quality and really a very clear assessment of recommendations and prioritizations and making choices. So I noticed we had lots of twos and, multiple fours. And that's good for a first start, but you're going to have to push the group to make decisions and present that to this committee and this board in a very clear and concise manner with justification as to why we think these are our biggest risks.
Absolutely, and what we will most likely do is, much like in the presentation, we will probably focus on probably the top 20 or so.
Good.
There's 188 so far. We can't possibly hope to address all those in a meaningful way. So we're going to focus on those that are the most critical, and those are the ones that will be at the top of the list, and we'll be able to talk about how we did the analysis and what put them at the top of the list. In some cases, you may have a very large risk, but it may be mitigated. So at the end of the day, it's not something that we worry about a lot. On the other hand, if you have a large risk that has not been effectively mitigated, then that's something with large cascading effect, and that's something that will be high up on the list. So we're going to focus on the top probably 20 or so.
That's good.
And key in on those. And as we work through those, then we'll work our way down the list. Okay.
And also identify those risks, if you're able to do that, that have the greater longevity of existence. So this has been a problem for the last 10 years, or this is just something that we've begun to identify in the last 6 months. Not that time is the dominant factor, but it identifies how systemic the issue is, and how also how hardened we might have become to the fact that it's there. So if we had a drip here and it's been dripping for 5 years, you might not notice that it's still dripping, you know, but it's still there. So put some time parameters onto the severity of the problem and of the issue. All right.
Certainly.
Any other questions or comments from Tim?
So a comment. I know that the intent here is not to look at the list right in detail,
right,
but it does jump off the page to me. On, you know, I look at, I would say our biggest risk is sustainability of revenue, right, both from the state and declining enrollment. And I don't see that. I do see a line that says insufficient revenue generating sources. The risk area says foundation and advancement. It just seems to me, boy, if we're down 1,000 students, that's $10 to $15 million of net revenues would be an enormous risk. And, of course, you look at our trend. So I would ask, is sustainability of revenue on here, and am I missing something that it would not be foundation and advancement? It would be.
Yeah, I believe liquidity is just a couple below where your finger is,
okay,
and that was the one identified by the finance team.
So liquidity would get. So let me carry that a little further. If we went to the action plan, then I would see eventually it would be. We need more students. I mean, we need a state budget sort of thing.
We might need a state budget too. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but that was identified, and it was identified in every meeting was the budget problem. But we indicated it that way.
I just didn't see it jump at the top, and then I saw foundation. So
right, and again, these haven't been mitigated, and that's one that won't be mitigated, so that will likely move higher as some of the ones above it get mitigated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Will?
First of all, I want to commend the work that has been done in this space. We clearly need this work, and we need to continue to move forward so we can mitigate the risk that's facing the institution. I want to put on my IT hat for a second and talk about risks associated with technology. A lot of times when institutions or organizations have tough financial or crisis like we have with a lack of budget, we often don't invest in some of the foundational or the infrastructure-related work that keeps our technology up and running. And therefore, the technology starts to age, and it gets to end of life. And we end up paying a premium to just get support from some of these companies to sustain them. And then it gets to a point where the company said, hey, no more. I'm a little concerned that I don't see much. I don't see. Maybe there's one or two loosely items that are on this list, and granted, it's a lot here. But I'm a little concerned that I don't see much about end of life equipment or technology that needs to be reinvested.
It is on the list. Again, the way these things appear on here is that we met with, for example,
sure,
Brett and his team,
sure,
and they scored each of the risks that they identified.
Sure.
And so currently their scores is what are represented there. Again, after some things are mitigated, some things will move up and some things will drop down.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't score them. They were scored by the IT group in saying, and those are on there, but certainly things like out-of-date equipment and switching equipment
Telephone system.
Those were all discussed and assessed, and so it was their scores that are there. The group itself doesn't score. We asked them to score, and that's where they put it.
Okay. So at first glance, and granted, it's a lot here. At first glance, and maybe it's embedded under some other title that I don't recognize. I think it's critical that we recognize that as an institution, and as we assess them and put risk scores associated with it, we've got to realize that if there's major failure with some of our technology, the whole institution comes to a halt in some cases.
Well, as you know, technology now tends to underpin everything that we do.
Right.
That is certainly something we're concerned about. Later today, you will hear my associate VP for facilities, John Heckman, talk about our long-range capital plan and prioritization plan for how we're getting a handle on our facilities needs and prioritizing, identifying those things. I'm having similar discussions with Brett for a longer range IT plan where we can incorporate those things, and we can talk about how we refresh our systems and equipment and make more strategic decisions to get at exactly the points that you're raising. It is a significant challenge. As we know, if your IT doesn't work, not much else does either. So it is certainly of concern. Like I said, we're not through this process, and this is weighed in the context of everything else. But separate from this, there's an effort going on to put together a long-range IT plan to address exactly those issues.
In light of the comments made by both of the trustees, let me make a suggestion when you prepare your final report. Why don't we have an executive summary? Mm-hmm. And in the executive summary, let's have subheadings. So subheadings related to enrollment or finance that relates to enrollment, physical plant, technology, maybe three or four big areas with a narrative. But let's have an executive summary.
Sure.
That will then feed into then the dashboards and the commentary on the dashboards.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Really, very much appreciated. Wonderful work being conducted by everyone. Thank you. Okay.
He has a second item as well.
Okay. All right.
Could I just say one?
Yes,
quick
please.
Thing?
Of course. Just, of course.
One thing that's kind of reflected across all these is the risk of losing our faculty and staff. It's kind of implicit in many of these. I just want to make that explicit, that given the context that we're in and also the fact we haven't had the liquidity to provide compensation increases for the last number of years, that's creating risk of turnover. And so that's something that we need to think about, kind of a horizontal issue across many of these vertical issues. To get back to your horizontal analogy. So I just want to mention that. That's one we're very aware of. We're working on building plans for that as our financial picture comes into a better focus.
Thank you. I think you have another point. You're back up again.
I'm going to be very popular today.
You always are.
The next item is the report of our fiscal year 15 external audit. In your handouts, you have an executive summary of the findings. The audit was conducted for the period July 1st, 2014 to June 30th, 2015. We had one financial finding, two federal findings, seven state findings, a total of 10. This was one more than last year. There were three new findings and seven repeat findings. A large number of these were administrative in nature. We are, in general, in the process of developing specific action plans for each one of these audit findings, and in some cases have already addressed them or working with the division responsible for the finding to put processes, procedures in place so that they do not reoccur. I do want to focus on a couple. If you go to finding five, this is a reoccurring finding, inadequate controls over contracts. We've made significant progress. Last year, 18 of 66 tested. Exceptions were found. This year, it was 2 of 40. We are in the process of creating a contracting office within the procurement office. We are working with the general counsel's office to review our procedures and re-engineer our entire procurement and contracting process, and we anticipate going forward that will eliminate these findings. The next finding is incomplete TA-2 form. This was a carryover finding from last year. This has been addressed. Unfortunately, it was not addressed before fiscal year 15, so it was also included in the audit findings for this year. This has, in fact, been addressed. Additional training has been conducted, and new process and procedures are in place to ensure that those problems no longer occur. And then finding number 9, procurement card use. We had a number of deficiencies in 14. We reduced from 33 to 7. This is another area where we are putting more specific focus on processes, internal controls, to ensure that these problems are also addressed going forward. And then number 10, inadequate controls over property and equipment. We could not find 244 items. I think we have somewhere in the vicinity of 60,000. A number of these were computers, which is of concern. We're working with IT to make sure that we have inadequate controls over our automation equipment. And the other thing we're doing is looking at better ways, such as using RFID technology and other ways to better account for our property and equipment. The state property accountability rules present a bit of a challenge because we have to account for things below $500. And we have a number of people who all they do all day is count property. So we are looking at those processes and procedures to ensure that there are internal controls in place so that these problems do not reoccur. The other thing I will say is that when we began this audit, we had a brand new controller. We did not have a deputy controller. We did not have an associate VP for budget and finance. And at the end of the 14 audit, I think I had been here 3 days before we got the exit conference. We have a relatively new, solid team in place. We have spent a considerable amount of time with our auditors. We recently had the entrance conference for the FY16 audit. You just finish one and go right into the next. We are working with them to restructure the way the audit is conducted so that things are done in a more timely manner and make it a little easier for us to respond to their requests. And given that, with our action plan that we have in place and are working through, I would anticipate that next year's audit, these findings will be reduced substantially.
Any questions or comments? Mark?
I know that you're interested in addressing these issues, and from the conversations that I've had with you, you know my concern about having this number of audit findings, and some of them in particular. My request was that we have particular action plans with identifiable people that we're capable of following up on in order to measure progress, because I'm not interested in having a repeat of the same findings that we've had the last several years. So can you provide some assurance that there is, in fact, an action plan with people responsible for addressing these issues now?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, my Larry Pinkleton, who's my AVP for Budget and Finance, and I've had several conversations about this. I asked him to put together an action plan. He has. I would be more than happy to provide you the names of the individuals we are working with to resolve these issues.
Thank you.
I too, take this very seriously.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Tim?
So I know I saw a draft of this report. Have we seen the final audit? Have the trustees seen the – have you delivered that to us in any form?
I don't know. I will be happy to send that out.
Yeah, I mean, I feel real uncomfortable getting a two-page summary of of a very important document. Boy, if I think that there's anything that would reach the top of the pile that we would get would be the audit. So I'd like to see that. Along Mark's comments, the follow-up, and I'll kind of weave this into the internal audit side of things. So, as I hear your reply to Mark, your department's in charge of following up on the findings to make sure they're remedied. Is that right?
The challenge is that these are not all created by my folks.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so we are working with, for instance, there were a couple of findings in research and innovative partnerships regarding grants. And mostly administrative, the timing, when things were done, they weren't done, when they should have been, or in a timely manner.
Sure. I think you've answered my question. I kind of get back to the fact that I would think this would be internal audit that would monitor the adherence to the action plan, right? Who's accountable? Or is it being accomplished? And I'll get back again to my general comments on internal audit. We get pieces and parts, but there's the missing overlay of what is with a scorecard of findings. So, for example, if there were things that were going back to 14, I mean, this is the first I've heard of it, that should be just jumping off the page on some report we would get that would be kind of red, would show me this is the first that I've heard about. So I get back, it's a circular kind of thing, to if there are findings, what is the status, who's responsible, and are we on target for completion? And that would be a very kind of regular, consistent report we would get. And it strikes me that it would be internal audit, especially because of the fact that it covers so many different areas.
The internal auditor is, in fact, a part of the audit process. And she does participate in the meetings that we have with the auditor in the Auditor General's office.
Okay. I would just think it would be on the top of the pile that this, to some degree, this report would be coming from them and not so much a department.
All right. Any other questions? I do have a comment, Dr. Phillips, and very much in light with the in line with my colleagues. I think that there's two things that strike me. One is the issue of oversight versus culture, and so I looked at Dr. Long and your help as well. If each person took a responsibility to do what they needed to do within the time frame that was mandated, it would mitigate the situation. So I think perhaps we might have a resurgence of discussion of culture, and it's not about from the oversight from the top down pushing something, but the responsibility of everyone to address these issues. So it's oversight versus culture, but it's not even a matter of money. If we had all the money in the world, you're still better off having a culture of every person appreciating that they need to do what they need to do in a timely manner. Mm-hmm. And that if they don't do that, they are impacting their colleagues. And we need to really emphasize that. And the other thought I had was in regards to point number 10, and you gave a proportional ratio, and I don't remember, it was 40 versus 60,000, or 244, what was it, 244 versus 60,000?
Correct. It was the total dollar amount, I think, was about 280,000, which is 0.13% of
okay.
our property.
Now,
value.
My comment about that is that's statistical versus historical. Mm-hmm. So statistically, if you made that comment in any room, one would say statistically it's inconsequential. But this particular finding relates to a historical situation that we've had at mm-hmm. NIU. And I think we need to be very attuned to that matter. And again, I think we need to go beyond what's ordinary and customary expectations of oversight to know that this was an area of great concern and ramifications for the university. We also know that the property belongs to the state of Illinois. Mm-hmm. We also know that the state of Illinois has philosophical issues with higher education in regards to certain matters, and we certainly don't want to feed those assumptions and presumptions that the state may have. So I just caution you that it is not just on its face, and it's not just statistical analysis, but putting some historical perspective mm-hmm. and also, Dr. Long, helping us in terms of heightening the cultural aspect of this of responsibility.
And to your point, this is also a problem experienced by our peer institutions.
As your mother
right.
said, you know,
so you
know,
this is
it's okay. You can look side to side and know it's probably a problem, but we're not gonna let that deter us here
no,
at NIU.
And I have had conversations with Brett about this and ways yeah. that we can get a handle on this because this yeah. is
maybe
you don't want to lose.
Maybe we'll be the we'll be exemplary. Maybe we'll be the where the bar is.
That would be the plan.
I think so, too. Thank you very much. Okay. Our special counsel and ethics officer, Mr. Gagliardo, you have some comments you'd like to make? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Thank you for having me here today. I want to talk a little bit about the fairly recent executive order that was put out by the governor. It's Executive Order 16-04. It's a long executive order that covers a range of topics that have basically deal with administrative investigations. I'm not going to cover the entire order here today, but wanted to highlight some of the key requirements that it puts on both agency ethics officers and all state employees. In the opening paragraphs of this executive order, the order reiterates the whistleblower protections that employees, university employees have. Whistleblower being namely those employees who raise genuine concerns about unethical, inappropriate, and or illegal behavior. The order then goes on with these whistleblower protections reiterated. The order goes on to discuss two key requirements of all state employees and for each agency ethics officer. The first key requirement set forth by this executive order is a requirement that each employee, quote, shall report promptly to the Inspector General's office and or the agency ethics officer, still quoting, any information concerning alleged misconduct by a state employee or a vendor, unquote. So in other words, if a state employee has knowledge that a fellow state employee engaged or vendor engaged in alleged misconduct, you have to report it. You have to report it either to your ethics officer or to the Inspector General's office. The order is very clear about that. Doesn't really give discretion. In fact, the order states that knowing failure of a state employee to report knowledge of misconduct could be cause for discipline up to including termination. So when you look at kind of the big picture in Illinois, we've really evolved quite a bit in this regard. At one time, there were no statutory whistleblower protections for Illinois state employees. And many employees were afraid to report wrongdoing because they feared retaliation by their employer, that they could actually lose their job if they, quote-unquote, ratted out their supervisor or ratted out some sort of authority figure. Now, we've had for some time protections against this. Now, we're more or less going to the other extreme, taking the next step, I guess you could say. An employee can be disciplined up to termination for failing to report this wrongdoing. So I guess that's the culture of Illinois. It's because of all that has happened, we're making sure that whistleblowers are not only protected, but that they have a duty to report this sort of misconduct if they have knowledge of it. The second key requirement set forth in the executive order is a requirement that each agency's ethics officer must now promptly notify the Inspector General's office of any allegations of misconduct after receiving such information. So if somebody tells me in good faith, quote, I believe X is engaged in wrongful conduct, I need to turn around and report that allegation to the Inspector General's office. I don't have any discretion on my part or whether or not, well, this, I don't think the Inspector General needs to know this. This is too small or they're too busy. I have to report it to them. They have to make that call whether or not they're going to take the case. So when you take these two requirements, adding those two requirements together means whenever an NIU employee has information about alleged misconduct of an employer or vendor, that information ultimately is going to go to the Inspector General's office. That's just what the governor wants, and that's what he's deemed in this order. Either the employee gives it directly to the Inspector General's office or gets it to the ethics officer who gets it to the Inspector General's office. Now, that doesn't mean that the Inspector General's office is going to investigate the case or that they're going to take any action. I know from experience in dealing with them, they're very backed up. If anything, they've been referring several investigations back to us. They're not going to take every case, but they at least have to hear about it so they can make that determination. Finally, this executive order allows both the Inspector General's office and the university to investigate at the same time. That is something new. It used to be when the Inspector General was investigating something, they did not want the agency investigating as well. And they may still specifically tell an agency, do not investigate what we investigate. But they also give now the agency's discretion whether or not we want to investigate. that's a case-by-case determination will be made. I don't know whether we have the resources to do that or whether it's prudent to do it in a lot of instances. So that will be a case-by-case determination.
Jeff,
yes.
Before you go on to any other topic,
sure.
Could you speak to one issue? I think it is very important that there are safeguards for whistleblowers, for individuals reporting, and I'm very happy to see that there's a procedure. But could you comment on whether or not there's been any discussion from the governor's office or any comments that you might make in terms of the responsibility of the individual who is identifying what is alleged to be misconduct and the individual sense of ethics that it's if something's to be reported, it must be based on evidence, based on fact, not on conjecture. Has there been any commentary from or guidance from the governor's office in regards to dual responsibility, the responsibility of protection, but the responsibility of assurance that what is being said is not conjecture?
There are protections, and basically in the language of the whistleblower statutes, the allegations have to be made in good faith. In other words, you have to have, if you're a whistleblower, you have to have some sort of evidentiary basis. It can be hearsay, it can be secondhand, but you have to have some sort of evidentiary basis to make allegations against a fellow employee or a state vendor. So, yes, the Whistleblower Protection Acts, both the Illinois Whistleblower Act and the Whistleblower Provisions of the State Officials Employees Ethics Act, both have that good faith basis built into those.
And as you do education and training in this regard, I would hope that you would emphasize that as well.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I was actually done with my comments before you asked the question, so nothing further.
Okay, that's it?
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
If there's another question.
What? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, please.
Just along the same point, when somebody comes with you with a complaint, as they have to do at this point, do you have any discretion to make a preliminary investigation to see if it is within good faith, or do you kind of have to take them for their word?
No, I do a preliminary investigation, okay. Basically mostly talking to them. And, sometimes I will determine it's not an ethics case, period. Without giving details of this case, I recently had a couple of employees come to me and make a complaint. We talked. They showed me documents. It was clearly a labor dispute that was covered by the collective bargaining agreement. I explained to them over the course of a couple meetings that after reading the collective bargaining agreement that it was a labor dispute. They can grieve it through the union process and have it arbitrated. So, yeah, I do a preliminary investigation, absolutely, before I'd even report to the OAG to make sure it actually is an ethics complaint and maybe not something along the lines of a labor dispute.
All right. Thank you very much.
If I can add a clarification as well to that. First of all, the new executive order nor the Whistleblower Act nor the State Officials and Employees Ethics Act make all state employees investigators. So your obligation is not to investigate. Those obligations are at other places, specifically with the ethics officer. Second is there are penalties associated for failure to provide information where there is a good faith basis, but there's also penalties associated with falsely accusing as well. So there are parallel provisions on both the penalty side for both failure to or to do so without a good faith basis.
That's correct.
Those are great comments, and I appreciate that the insight, Jerry. I would my hope is I got two questions really or two concerns with a resolution like this. One, do you have the manpower to support and to answer all of the questions? And then from a training perspective, making sure all of the employees of the institution as well as even maybe some of our vendors are aware of the guidelines on which they would be needed going forward.
Good questions. We're dealing with the resource issue through the program prioritization process. As a matter of fact, that's part of the we've gotten the report, we've read the report, and we've been invited to make comments about the report. And one of the comments that we're going to be talking about is this new executive order. I do possibly expect an uptick of investigations. I would be surprised if there are not an uptick of investigations. We already have quite a few right now, and they're backlogged, and many have not even been started. They've been sitting around for a while. So, yes, there is always a resource concern when something like this comes out. The second question, could you repeat? The second question was about...
Well, first of all, manpower and then... Training in terms of making sure all the employees and possibly the vendors are aware of the guidelines and rules and making sure there's not misabuse of this resolution.
Yes, it's very important. And I talked to General Counsel Blake Moore yesterday about how do we get the word out on this, and he said, well, number one, speak about it here at this board meeting. Number two, I think we're going to be approaching perhaps the provost and the president about how we can perhaps best get this word out either by email or any other means. Not only that, what the executive order says, but also these cautionary points that you and Chair Muir have brought up about whistleblower responsibility, not just rights. Sure. Make sure there's a basis to not make false allegations.
Sure.
This itself would be misconduct.
Sure, and I think that's really important. I want to also say that for about 20 to 25 years or so ago, or not ago, but within 20 to 25 years, I worked for a corporation that had a similar rule in place. So there's obligation among all employees. If there's wrongdoing, it is your job to raise your hand to say that there's wrongdoing. But it's not your job to be a private investigator or to, you know, try to record people or that kind of stuff. It is your job to report it, and that's your duty as an employee. And then the agency, whether the ethics office or some other office or the immediate supervisor, it is their responsibility to ensure that it is kind of investigated and covered. But there could be potential abuse of this. Right, and we need to be aware of that, and there could be some misuse of this, right? People with personal, personal agendas that are trying to go after other folks, and so we need to be aware of that as well, and that's why we got to emphasize within the training that if you're found to be, doing something that is or raising your hand that is vindictive in nature and trying to get at somebody without. Good faith, then you could be subject to termination as well.
That's, yes,
I think what is also interesting is our rules that we have in place with some of our collective bargaining groups as well in terms of protection and how did this come into play in terms of penalizing or individuals for actions that are not in good faith.
Yes, everything's interrelated. That's a good point.
Yeah.
I just want to make a last comment in all this regard. Excuse me, please.
On the comprehensive inclusion of the groups that would fall under this mandate, part-time workers and student workers, I assume, are included?
Yes. Yes.
That was an excellent question.
Yeah, anybody who's on a payroll, whether student, employee, or a part-time employee, 900-hour employees, all of them would be subject to this order.
Okay. My last comment in this regard, just to summarize what we've all been saying, is that the training aspect of this may really be the most critical aspect.
Yeah.
And when you talk about resource utilization and allocation, my experience really is that when someone makes comments such as this that can be very serious allegations, the worst thing is if it's done with malice and for purposes of vindictiveness, and that's a whole other issue, and that's a whole other HR situation. But my experience is that words like ethics sometimes mean different things to different people. And when we use the word ethical compliance of regulations, more so from a legal standpoint, there's an understanding of what that means. I think that it would be imperative that in your training that you really, we may all know what we mean, but you have a lot of people, and especially if it goes to students who are in the process of maturing themselves, that they understand what does it mean to use the word ethical? What does it mean to say there was a wrongdoing? And what seriousness does that accompany? And I think that if we can have a real strong understanding of what it means to be accusatory and a responsibility to be able to be evidence-based, we are all in agreement that we want those things. These things must be brought to the attention of the organization. But I think that you could save a lot of time and resources and have a better organization if we took the time to not only define these things, but continue to give examples so that it's meaningful to people, you know. And using some case studies would be really helpful. If a person does this, is this unethical? And help, because the answer may be no, it's not, but, you know, maybe it was rude.
Right.
You know, what's the difference between someone being rude or someone not being, or someone being careless to someone being unethical to heighten it to the point that we need investigations?
Yes.
And so I really encourage you, Mr. Blakemore, through your office in particular, to take a leadership role in that.
I appreciate those comments. One of the reasons that the ethics officer made reference to coordinating whatever is done in this with the president and the provost in particular is because this needs to be done in conjunction with other areas. Our harassment policy, as an example, becomes an issue, particularly given what you've just said. And so we will, I mean, this is relatively new. It is a requirement. We're going to develop a process for the training and the investigations and the like on it, but you're absolutely right. This cannot stand in and of itself. It's really part of a bigger issue, and the definitions of what's legal, what's ethical, they are different. There are different standards associated with it, and without overcomplicating it, we want to make certain that the employees have every opportunity to understand it so that they can comply.
Okay. All right.
And just to note, all employees go through an annual ethics training.
Good.
So
under whose office?
That's from the state.
Oh, from the state.
So, okay. Yeah, it's an extensive training with case studies.
Good. Okay.
So that's already done.
Good. Excellent. Okay, we're going to move along. Thank you very much. Ms. Schultz, I think you have an informational item, and then it will be followed up by an action item.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, trustees. The Internal Audit Department is required to comply with the Institute of Internal Auditors International Standards for the Professional Practice of Internal Auditing, the Code of Ethics, and also the Fiscal Control and Internal Auditing Act of the State of Illinois. These standards require our internal audit function to have a review at least once every 5 years. Our most recent review was completed in the month of April. Our final report was presented to the State Internal Audit Advisory Board in Springfield last week for approval. The report reflects that we are in conformance with the IIA standards and the requirements of the Fiscal Control and Internal Auditing Act. We expect the SIAAB to issue their approval of our review to President Baker within this month. The standards also require that I provide information and results regarding this review to both senior management and the board. President Baker and I have discussed our review, and by the way of this information item, I'm presenting it to the Carl Committee. If anyone has any questions about our review, I'd be happy to share a report once we get the final approval from the SIAAB with this committee, but at this time, I just want to take this opportunity to present you with an update. Does anybody have any questions?
That it focuses on quality, but is there also benchmarking done regarding the adequacy of staff and the productivity of the staff?
You're correct. It's a quality assurance review, which is the way it's phrased and classified in the standards from the State Internal Audit Advisory Board. They do not look at staffing levels. This is done, one person shops at other universities as well as U of I all go through the same evaluation, but they do not look at staffing levels, no.
Is there any process by which we benchmark those items?
I would say our most recent benchmarking of those items was done during program prioritization, and that was part of my narrative to that process.
Thank you.
Would that more appropriately go through the provost office in terms of staffing in your office?
Yeah, yeah. It reports to the president.
Would you address that, how we look to adequacy of not only adequacy of staffing, but productivity? Those were Chairman Strauss's comments.
So Danielle and I do sit and talk about the audit plan for the year and then the personnel relative to that. I think she started the year in pretty good shape. We felt confident about that. She had some turnover this year. Mm-hmm. And that's,
and still have a vacancy right now.
And still have a vacancy. So we need to get that filled and get them back up to their adequate funding level. So we're in the process of doing that now.
Was that your question? I think I might have misunderstood. I thought you meant overall staffing and productivity. Did you mean the internal audit department?
I mean within
the
internal audit office.
Then I misunderstood.
And I'm interested in whether we have benchmarked that in some way.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and then I'd be happy to share my narrative, if that's appropriate, with you, Mark, if you would like, for program prioritization. It compares number of staff and number of audits completed during the most recent completed fiscal year with other institutions in the state.
All right. If there are no other questions in regards to this, are there? No. Then you have an action item you'd like to bring before us?
I do. This item lists the standards our audit department must follow, which is what I just mentioned in the information item. Last November, I provided detailed information about the standards and with regard specifically to how the requirements that were pertaining to both the board and the president. What I didn't include last November, which I usually include every year in my presentation, is the definition of internal auditing, just to make sure you're aware of that, and the reference to the internal audit code of ethics, and that are found on the last page. I think that you received a supplement to your booklet. So if the supplement document that you have on the last page has the definition of internal auditing and reference to the code of ethics for your information. The standards require that I periodically review our internal audit charter and present to senior management and the board for approval. I've completed a periodic review of our charter, and there are no significant changes needed at this time. Our charter was reviewed during our peer review, and it meets all the requirements of the standards and the Fiscal Control and Internal Auditing Act of the State of Illinois. However, during our review, we were advised that in order to meet the requirement of periodically approving it, that I do need to make sure that even if we don't have any changes, that it comes before the board and gets approved officially once every 5 years. So that's what I would like to bring it to you at this time so that you can review it and approve it. And that is found on pages 2 through 4 of that handout for you.
Before I ask for a motion, are there any areas of clarification or questions you have for Ms. Schultz? Yes, Tim?
So as I read the charter, it on the first line it says, provide independent and objective assurance and consulting services to assist the Board of Trustees and University Management in the effective discharge of their oversight, management, operating responsibilities. So when I read that, and you and I have spent some time on this, right, I ask myself the simple question of how are we doing in that regard, right? How's the university doing with respect to following policies and procedures and providing accurate information, much like Dr. Phillips provided the findings, you know, on the state's report. I still struggle with getting arms around it or having a document that would provide the answer to that, right? How many outstanding items are there? How long are those outstanding items? Are they being remedied? How are we doing relative to history, et cetera? I still have yet to see anything that would, for example, we talked about the historical piece today, and there was an item on the findings from the state, and Sherilyn had mentioned, boy, this is a historical issue. That's the piece that's missing, right? To mm-hmm. show us that we shouldn't have to find that in the bowels of the organization, that it's a historical issue. It ought to jump off the page and be really clear, which then that'll lead us to action, so it's not a repeatable kind of thing. So as I read the audit or the charter, the language is excellent and I fully support it, but then I have to ask my question. So in that first sentence, what is it that you're providing to us other than reports from time to time that would give us confidence that we are meeting the language in the charter? So I don't so much expect an answer other than I want to go on record again, I think for the third time, of simply looking for a dashboard, clear report with addressing the overall how are we doing in our audit department.
I would like to make a respond to that. So yes, and you have been receiving each and every one of our reports, not just periodically, but each of our reports are provided to you guys. Also, the president and I have been working on a report that we can provide on a quarterly basis that will identify recommendations that have not yet been implemented but have passed the time of expected implementation. So not sure that you want to be inundated with 100, no. But more.
As Sherilyn mm-hmm. had mentioned before, we need, I use the example right of buying bonds. If someone bought a bond every day and at the end of a year they say, how is that bond portfolio doing? You would have no ability to answer that question. So as I get every single audit report, we can't be expected to understand how we're doing with respect to following policies and procedures. So we need a concise, very high level directional report that make it clear, are we trending, are we getting better or worse, are there serious issues, are they all small issues, are they and what is the direction of the risk? That's the piece. So don't confuse me with asking for more. It's asking for a high-level summary exactly in the risk management protocol when there was 160-some things. Want it at a high level that's very clear, very concise. So if there is a problem brewing within the organization somewhere, we're not going to find that on a footnote on page 17 of one of 25 audits that we receive. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to make a comment?
Well, just as Danielle said, you're getting quarterly reports on the exceptions that are not implemented. So look for those. We'll highlight those and be happy to sit down and go okay. through them in detail. The number of things not addressed are small, so they may fly by you. But Danielle's doing a good job tracking to make sure that when people say, yeah, we're going to do that, that they, yeah, go do that.
I just want that assurance, right?
I understand.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think what we have might be just a matter of communication. And so it's the responsibility of the organization to make sure that the board has what it feels it needs. But on the other hand, it's the responsibility of the board to give commentary based on what we are receiving. So we need to look at the quarterly summaries. And I would ask Trustee Struthers to continue to articulate, looking at those quarterly summaries, what's the piece that's still missing? Right. And then I ask the President and Ms. Schultz to also be attentive to that question. Okay?
Yeah.
So it's both sides.
Yeah,
all
I right. appreciate the feedback, and Trustee Struthers and I have had some further conversations, and we've been able, I understand more of what he would like, and it's just a matter of getting that
great.
All put together in a report that we can do in a manner, on a routine manner.
Good.
I just want to go on the record.
Yes.
I support my colleague here in terms of trying to have some kind of comprehensive mm-hmm. dashboard view.
Absolutely.
Of how well are we doing, what's our critical audit findings, and how well are we moving towards rectifying them.
And I want to make sure, because, Well, it'll. I have this on my agenda to talk to with Chair Muir a little bit further to make sure we are hitting what you are requesting. Because not just what I hear you saying, Trustee Coleman, is that what are the critical issues? But if those issues are immediately rectified, then it may not make it to the report that we've been working on of outstanding items not followed, not actually taken action upon. So. I want to make sure that I'm hitting everybody's request appropriately. So,
I would like to make a public comment that I've had the opportunity to work with Danielle for many years in different capacities and different chairmanships. I have found her to be one of the most diligent and attentive individuals here at this university. And one of the individuals who I've found has truly appreciated the seriousness of her position. I think what we're talking about now is we're all at a heightened level mm-hmm. of accountability and responsibility, and I think that what the comments may simply be is formatting, sure. communication and formatting. So it's a balance, and it's a work in progress, and it's also something that's evolutionary. Because what we might have wanted to know 10 years ago
right.
is not what we need to know today. And that's because of the circumstances that we right. find ourselves in. So, but I think the comments of the board are very well taken and express the seriousness of this board and this committee to take the responsibility to know if there are any issues that are at hand. I think what the committee is simply saying is we don't want to be surprised.
Right.
So, Bob?
I just want to repeat what you said about Danielle, and I was the past chair of CAL committee, and certainly she is one of the most intensive member of our staff here, and I've always found her work to be exemplary, so I want to just repeat what you said in backing her ability to do a very good job.
So I also want to go on record saying I am not criticizing Danielle for your work and your performance. You clearly take your job seriously. You know, we put some suggestions on the table to the president and to others to create a dashboard for the university, the most critical items that the board needs to pay attention to, and we're getting that dashboard. We've seen examples of those dashboards. And as it relates to audit and audit findings and compliance and completing those audit findings, we're saying it's great we're getting quarterly reports now, but it would be nice to get a high-level, comprehensive view of those yep. reports. And so this is about a continuous improvement so we can better do our jobs, so we can better pay attention to outstanding. I didn't support Absolutely. Danielle when we're in situations mm-hmm. where things are not getting done where they should be.
Right. Absolutely. Right? I agree.
Excellent discussion to have on record because it shows everyone's intent. And I will, as Daniel said, we're meeting and we're going to try and synthesize in the same way that I asked Dr. Phillips to do an executive summary to be able to articulate in a manner that we're able to understand not only the detail but also the overview. And I think that's what this committee is asking for. So in that regard, hearing no other comments, do I have a motion? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm prepared to make a motion.
Yes.
That this committee recommend to the Board of Trustee approval of the internal audit charter as presented.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All in, any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've had just extraordinary conversation and discussion this morning, and it really was extremely substantive and went to a great depth. So I thank my colleagues on this committee for that type of conversation. Our next CARL committee meeting is scheduled for August 25th. May I have a motion to adjourn the meeting? Do I have a second? All in favor? Opposed? Motion approved. We are adjourned. Thank you very much.